for the first of such of these attempts, Blondin stood at the crowd and he said, "Do you believe I can carry someone across this tightrope with a person on my back?" And the crowd says, we believe. And then he says, "Well, so who's going to volunteer, right?" Dead silence, right? Then he points to a man in the crowd and says, "Do you believe that I can do it?" And he says, "I believe." And he hops on his back and he walks across the tightrope with him. Well, we come to find out that the man pictured here is Harry Colcord, his manager. Yes, theatrical, right? It was his manager. And this, you know, Harry Colcord has been used for illustrations of faith in gospel presentations probably since it happened. And it really is a remarkable testimony to faith. But what people don't realize is that Harry did this very reluctantly. He actually, he was planning on putting a line in the middle, a rope down to the base in the middle of the line, just in case the great Blondin had problems. And then when he got out on the line, it began to sway and list, and he was petrified. And he almost caused Blondin to fall. Blondin had to calm him down and said, "If you don't stop grabbing my neck, I'm going to leave you out here." You see, when Harry Colcord, the one who knew Blondin's accomplishments the most, he's seen him train, he's seen him do these stunts over and over and over again. Even he, when he was asked to follow him out on this tightrope, he was fearful. And you can't blame him, right? What's he doing out there? He doesn't have the abilities. He doesn't have the skills. In some sense, you could hear him saying, "Who am I to go out there and do such a thing?" Well, that's, I think, often what we ask ourselves when following God means great personal risk. Some of you, just a second ago, when Steve was up here telling about the time that he shared his gospel, you were probably sitting there saying, "I could never do that. Who am I?" It seems so natural for him. Why is it so difficult for me? How could God use me in that way? Sometimes, you know, we fear when we see Steve Bergstrom coming down the hall. All these illustrations aren't about Steve, mind you. But we see Steve coming down the hall and we say, "Oh no, he's going to ask me to do children's church." Who am I to do something like that? What do I have to offer? I didn't go to Bible college. I certainly didn't go to seminary. Who am I? Perhaps some strike even deeper when we doubt our ability to follow God in caring for an ill spouse. Maybe taking care of aging parents. Maybe trying to raise children who want to go their own way. And we sit there and we ask, who are we to follow God in honoring him in these ways? We have too much baggage. We are too needy. You see, we're beset with insecurity, failure, and doubt when God asks us to follow him in the things of this life. And yet, because we love him, we want to do it. We want to follow him, right? We want to step out on that tightrope with God and move forward. So the question for us today is, how do we become extraordinary followers of God? How do we become extraordinary followers of God? Not just people who have placed their faith in Christ, but people who will step out in faith through the course of life and say, "I believe who you are, God." How do we become extraordinary followers of God? Well, this morning we're going to look at Exodus 3, and there are two answers that God gives us in this text, and they center around who we are and then who God is. So these two answers centered around who we are and who God is. Firstly, how do we become extraordinary followers of God? We accept who we are. People who need God's presence. Let's turn to Exodus 3. Now, when Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, He led the flock to the far side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. The angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that the bush was on fire and it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I will go over to see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. And when the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, here I am. Those are great words, aren't they? Here I am. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. Then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. Verse 7, the Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And God said, I will be with you. And this will be a sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. We become extraordinary followers of God when we accept who we are. And who we are is people who need God's presence. You see, Moses and the Israelites, when he received this call, and the Israelites, when they received the book of Exodus, definitely needed to accept this. If you go all the way back to the beginning of Exodus, it begins with the Israelites having been in captivity to the Egyptians. And there's that key phrase that the king, the Pharaoh, came to power who did not know Joseph and therefore did not regard Israel. In fact, Israel's growing population became a threat to the Egyptians, and so they enslaved them. And they began to kill off the children in order to keep the population under control. Moses himself was one of these babies who was saved by being placed in a basket in the Nile River and being rescued by Pharaoh's daughter. When he grows up and realizes his identity, he finds himself a fugitive after killing the Egyptian and burying him in the sand. And even when he goes to his own people, they reject him. He's too much of an Israelite for the Egyptians, and he's too much of an Egyptian for the Israelites. And Moses needs to accept it. The Israelites, when they receive this book, they're in the wilderness at this time, and they need to accept it. They're relying upon God for food, for water, for safety. At any time, armies could attack them along their wandering, and they come up to the Jordan River, and they have to figure out a way to cross it. And even if they do cross it, they're supposed to take the Promised Land, which is inhabited by all of these armies. Who are they to do such a thing? But even long before that, at the time of Moses, they're in captivity in Egypt. And John Durham helps give us a picture of what that meant. He writes, the God of the fathers, this is Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, in various times and places and under various conditions, had proved himself to the fathers. But Egypt and the bondage there present a new situation. Egypt is a world power. The Israelites in slavery are in no way peers of their oppressors as the fathers had been peers of their neighbors and even their enemies. Indeed, the plight of the Israelites in Egypt is entirely unparalleled in the history of the fathers, in the history of Israel up to this point, who had to contend with local groups, local rulers, and local gods. The Egyptians, who were possessed by an extensive pantheon of gods, exerted a cooperative lordship over every aspect of life in granting international influence to Egyptian power. Indeed, the Pharaoh himself claimed divine descent. And to make matters worse, God appears to Moses and says, I want you to go there and lead these people out. I want you to go back into the lion's den, if you will, to the government from whom you are running, to a people who won't follow you or who don't want to follow you, and I want you to lead them out. God asks Moses to follow me. This is what God says, so that they will follow you. And Moses responds probably like the rest of us would. Who, me? Are you talking to me? Who am I to do such a thing? What can I bring to the table? What skills or talents do I have? Of course, if you continue to read on in the book of Exodus, you find that Moses points out that he's not very good at speaking and he needs the ability to do certain signs. And perhaps all of that is true, but he asks a pretty good question. Who am I? I have too much baggage. Surely if I go back to the Egyptians, I'll be captured and killed. And even if I'm not, why would Israel listen to me? Folks, we're right there with Moses. Now, I don't know about you, but I haven't seen many burning bushes lately, and I haven't been asked to lead a nation out of captivity. But in identifying with Jesus Christ and saying, I follow him, and when you say that same thing, we are faced with a calling. And that calling manifests itself in various aspects of life. And we face insecurity in that. For example, when we share the gospel, we're insecure about that because we say, what if I fumble my words? Or what if I'm rejected? What will that do to our friendship? Or, you know, if we're trying to honor God with the way that we parent, and we say, I wasn't raised in a home that had very good parents. Or maybe I was raised in a home with great parents, and there's no way I could reproduce that. We have insecurities about that. We say, who are we to do such a thing? Maybe some of you, you're not taking care of young kids. They're adult kids, and you're in retirement. And you wonder, who am I? How could God use me as I age in life? And you know what? That's a good question to ask. Because the reality is, we are needy people, just like Moses was. The baggage that we all have, and we all have baggage, folks, makes us needy people. And what is most compelling about the way that God responds is that he doesn't chastise Moses. But notice what he says. When Moses says, who am I? He says, I am with you. Now, that's a peculiar answer. He doesn't build up Moses and say, Moses, you really are a great speaker. You have confidence in yourself. You remember that Toastmasters class? You could go to that, and then you'll be able to lead these people. He doesn't say, you know, you came from royalty. You had all the best education. And you know, in all your intellect, you know all about the Egyptian gods, so you'll be able to argue. No, he doesn't say that, does he? He says, Moses, this is who you are. You are the one who I am with. You are the one who I am with. So when Moses squares off against the Egyptian deities, it's not Moses, but it's God who is with him. And when he leads the people out of the desert, it's not Moses, it's God who is with them. A great illustration of this I was talking with my mom about this, and she has a dear friend. Her name is Frances von Helm. Frances right now is 94 years old. And for 52 years, she worked as a school secretary. But at the age of 52, felt the Lord was calling her to minister and serve the Navajo people up in northern Arizona and New Mexico. And so for 40 years, she engaged in what she called service ministry. She would help them get to the doctor's office. She would help them fill out forms. She'd get groceries for them. Just anything that they needed that she could do, she would do. About 2 years ago, she broke her hip. And that really caused a downward spiral in her health. She lost her eyesight. She became bedridden. And she asked, "Who am I? How can I help? My ministry is done. I can't even move. I can't even get out of bed to go to church." But for the last 2 years, Frances has devoted herself to prayer, literally. Every waking moment, she spends praying through the lists of her head, and she imagines the people that she knows in where they sit in church, right? So if she were here, she'd say, "I want to pray for Leslie Bergstrom," and she's sitting right over there, and I want to pray for her at work, that she's bold. And she goes through the lists in her head, and she has maps in her head of missionaries that she prays for from her bed for every waking hour. If she wakes up in the middle of the night, she begins praying because she figures God wants her to pray. That's why she's awake. But she does this not because of who she is, but because of the God who is present with her there, but also the God who is present with those for whom she prays. 94 years old and doesn't miss a beat. We can learn something from Frances. We can learn that when we follow God in an extraordinary way, it begins with accepting who we are, that we need his presence. We need him. There is no doubt about it. We need him to work through us and in us, whether that's sharing the gospel, whether that's taking care of family members who are ill or aging, whether it means raising children, whether it means working in children's church, whether it means talking to a colleague at work. We need to accept who we are, that people who need God's presence. But the next question that Moses asks is actually perhaps maybe a more profound one. He asks in verse 13, "Who are you? It's well and good that you're with me, God, but who exactly are you? Why should that make a difference?" It's a very provocative question. If we're honest with ourselves, it's great that you're here, but who exactly are you? And God responds with this statement, "I am." And this leads us to the second way that we become extraordinary followers of God. We acknowledge who God is. And that means we acknowledge that he is, that he exists, that his presence is not bound by time, and the significance that makes for us. Let's pick it up in verse 13. And Moses said to God, "Suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you.' And they ask me, 'What is his name?' Then what shall I say to them?" God said to Moses, "I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites: 'I am has sent me to you.'" God also said to Moses, "Say to the Israelites, 'The Lord,'" this is Yahweh, "'the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you, and this is my name forever, the name you shall call me from generation to generation. Go, assemble the elders of Israel and say to them, The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, appeared to me and said, I have watched over you and have seen what has been done to you in Egypt, and I have promised to bring you up out of your misery in Egypt and into the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey. And the elders of Israel will listen to you. And then you and the elders are to go to the king of Egypt and say to him, 'The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. Let us take a 3-day journey into the wilderness to offer sacrifices to the Lord our God. But I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless a mighty hand compels him. So I will stretch out my hand and I will strike the Egyptians with all the wonders that I will perform among them. And after that, he will let you go.'" We become extraordinary followers when we acknowledge who God is, when we acknowledge that he is. Moses asks God for a name, but if you recall back in verse 6, God has already identified himself, right? He's the God of our fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And based on Moses' response, he understands this, right? He says, "At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God." But what Moses really seems to be asking here is not simply for a name, but for a reputation. He wants to know if God is truly trustworthy. Can God make good on the promise that he is promising here in this passage? After all, the Israelites have been in slavery for quite some time. And in some sense, for all appearances, the gods of the Egyptians, Ra and others, have ruled over, from the appearance of human, have they ruled over Yahweh? So Moses is asking for a reputation, and God says, "I am who I am." Now, what's interesting about this request of Moses, I was trying to think of a parallel, and maybe the best parallel to this in our day and age is what we see in professional basketball, the National Basketball Association. The best players over the course of their career will acquire a nickname, and that nickname is indicative of their reputation as a good player. I'll give you a couple examples. Kobe Bryant, who plays for the Lakers, his nickname is the Black Mamba. Okay, the Black Mamba is this lethal snake. Kobe Bryant has assumed this nickname because he's known for these game-winning shots, for winning games at the end of close games. And so they say, he's just like the Black Mamba. He has this strike that's deadly. There's Shaquille O'Neal, who recently retired. His name is the Diesel, like a Big Mac truck. He's one of the largest players to play in the history of the NBA. He's 7'1", 325 pounds, probably more than that now. But he would use his size to basically build a Hall of Fame career in the NBA. Tim Duncan, who plays for the Spurs, they call him the Big Fundamental because his basketball movements are so fundamentally sound. If you're going to teach someone how to play this position, you need to watch Tim Duncan, the Big Fundamental. Well, in some sense, Moses wants a reputation from God, and God says, "I am who I am." Take a look. Verse 14, God said to Moses, "I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am the ever-present one. The one who eternally is has sent you. Say to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God who made promises to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, he is the one who has sent you." And what God is picturing and revealing of himself is that he is, as we've learned, the God who exists wholly unto himself, that he never changes, that time does not hold him. Millard Erickson says that God is timeless. He does not grow or develop, and there are no variations in his nature at different points within his existence. The interests, knowledge, activities, and even personalities of humans change from childhood to youth, to adulthood, to old age. But with God, there is no such change, however. He has always been what he is. God says, "The promise that I made to your forefathers, I am that same God. I am the same today." He is the ever-present one. He is never surprised. He is always sufficient for the needs of his people. And Hamilton, so aptly puts it this way, and it's a long quote, but it's powerful. He says, Moses asked after God's name, and Yahweh responded, not by a label, but a theology. That is to say, God will always be there for his people in a distant Egypt too, even if that divine presence is questioned and imperceptible. He will always be whatever his people need him to be in any given moment, in any given place. If they need a deliverer, that's Yahweh. If they need grace and mercy and forgiveness, that's Yahweh. If they need purifying and empowerment, that's Yahweh. If they need rebuke and chastisement, that's Yahweh. If they need guidance, that's Yahweh. For God is a, I love this, I will be what I will be, God. And a, I will be what I need to be for you, God. And the implications of this are so profound. It means that the God who is eternally attentive to the needs of his people. In verse 7, I have indeed seen the misery of my people. I have heard their crying, and I am concerned. Verse 9, and now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. It means that when we suffer, when we hurt, God is attentive to our needs. He is eternally attentive. It is always before him. It means that the God who is eternally faithful to fulfill his promises. The promise that he made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was for land, seed, and blessing. And what is he going to do with the nation? He's going to lead them into the land flowing with milk and honey. He has not forgotten. He has not forgotten. And then in the future here, when Moses will go into the land, or go into Egypt, to bring the Israelites out, it is his hand, right? But I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless a mighty hand compels him. So what does God say? I will stretch out my hand and I will strike the Egyptians. He is at this moment, for Moses and for us, eternally making the promise and also fulfilling it, because he always is. The God who is not just attentive to our needs and not just faithful, but he's also gracious to include us in his program. He takes a man who is a fugitive, an outcast among his own people, and we find that he's a shepherd. Perhaps he's slow of speech. We have no idea. But we see he's a man with baggage, a man with a history, with a past, just like each of us. And he includes him in his program. And the way that God is able to do that is that he is everything he always is, always. He never changes. He is everything he always is. He never forgets, and he never is unaware. In becoming extraordinary followers, then, it means to acknowledge the God who is. Moses did this. We know that he acknowledged this because eventually he does go into Egypt and he does confront Pharaoh, because he believes that God is with him, that God is eternal. Israel, believe it or not, for all of their failings, believe this, because they followed Moses out of Egypt, because the I Am sent Moses. And they followed God through the wilderness. And they followed God across the Jordan River when the flood banks were high. And they even followed God into the promised land, even though that meant doing battle with the pagan societies. We know that they acknowledged God as eternal, the God who is. And so the challenge for us is to acknowledge the God who is, to recognize that he is always attentive to our needs, always attentive to our needs. He knows our cries and our suffering like he does the Israelites. He is forever faithful to bring the church into the new earth. That world that Steve described is the world of redemption fully realized in the new earth. He's made that promise to us, and he is faithful to fulfill it. Why? Because he is. And he is gracious to use us in the midst of our insecurities and our failures and our doubts. Will we be poised to respond? Will we follow him out on that tightrope? Perhaps it's today. Perhaps it's dealing with a family member. Perhaps it's the opportunity this week to tell people about Jesus Christ from a place of genuine concern. Recognizing, Lord, I do have baggage and I am insecure, but you are with me because you are. And coming back to Harry Colcord, I was thinking about Harry Colcord and the many others that either hopped on the great Blondin's back or hopped into the wheelbarrow that he would carry them across this tightrope. I was thinking about, they were fully aware of his skill, and they were fully aware that they lacked anything to help God. And they were fearful. It's said that Blondin, when he was getting people ready, and even when they were out on the rope, he would talk to his companions in the most indifferent ways, basically to calm them down. You know, what's the latest movie you've seen? You know, stuff like that. How about the weather? He would urge them to sit perfectly still, and he asked them not to squeeze him around his neck. That's always a nice request, right? And above all, don't look down. But what amazes me the most about each of these folks is not the faith that they exerted or that they exhibited in the great Blondin's ability to do this, but it's the fact that the great Blondin had a reputation to compel such faith. At what point do you say, okay, I've seen this trick enough, I'm going to hop on his back? It's profound. Truly, he was an amazing high wire acrobat. The God who is, quite literally, is infinitely greater than the great Blondin. His reputation as the creator of the world, as the self-existent one, as the one who never changes, is so great that how could we do any less than those folks in trusting him? Let us become extraordinary followers of God by accepting who we are, people that need his presence, and by acknowledging who he is, that he is present with us. Let's pray. Father, what a compelling challenge to us today. And we confess that we are fearful because the high wires that we face in our life seem to put us even at greater risk, feels at sometimes, than and walking across a real high wire. But we take confidence in the fact that your abilities, your reputation, is far greater than any human being, any group of people, any nation, any society that ever was or ever will be. For you are our creator. You are wholly separate from this world, and yet we find here that you care for us. You care for your people. You promise to be with us, and indeed, you reveal yourself to be the one who is ever present everywhere. How profound. We ask that the Spirit would guide us in what that looks like as we face those tightropes, sharing the gospel, taking care of family members, raising children, what to do with retirement, how to function at work. The list goes on, and yet you know them all because you know our needs. Help us to accept this and to believe who you are. for your glory and the glory of your Son. It's in his name that we pray.